age against you before you facilitate any interaction. You can't control those things, but you can control aspects of your appearance, such as clothing, body odor, and cleanliness, as well as your eye contact, body movements, and facial expressions. I read a statement once that I have seen proven true too many times to ignore. If a person is not comfortable with himself, others will not be comfortable with him either. Be aware of your pretext and your target. If your pretext is the janitor, make sure your demeanor, dress, attitude, and words reflect someone in that position. If your pretext is a manager of a business, then make sure you act and dress appropriately. This takes research, but nothing kills rapport easier than not looking the part. Your goal in some instances is to keep people in the autopilot mode that will let them not question you. Having your dress, grooming, or demeanor out of place removes the target from autopilot and hurts your chances at success. Be a good listener. See the earlier section for more details. The importance of good listening can't be overstated. Whether you are trying to make a friend or make a social engineering move, listening is a skill you need to master. Be aware of how you affect people. One time, I saw an older woman drop an item as she left a grocery store. I picked it up and followed her out to the parking lot. By the time I caught up with her, she had her trunk open and was loading groceries into her car. I came up behind this short, elderly woman and, with all 6'3" of me looming over her, said, "Excuse me, ma'am." I was obviously too close for her comfort, and when she turned around, she screamed out, "Help! He's trying to mug me! Help!" I obviously needed to think about how my presence might affect this woman during my interaction with her. I should have realized that an elderly woman all alone in a parking lot who was not expecting a huge man to walk up behind her might freak out. I should have come around and approached her from a different angle. Be aware of how your appearance and other personal aspects might affect those you will be in contact with. Do you need a breath mint? Make sure no food is on your face or in your teeth. Try to be relatively sure that nothing is glaring in your personal appearance that will turn the person off. UCLA professor of psychology Albert Mehrabian is known for the 7-38-55 rule, which states that statistics show that only 7% of normal communication is the words we say, whereas much more lies in the body language and vocal tones. Try to be aware of yourself, but also pay attention to the first few seconds of interaction with a person. His or her reaction to your approach can tell you whether you possibly missed something or whether you need to change something to be more effective. As a social engineer, be aware of how you affect people. If your end goal is all that is on your mind, you will affect the people you come into contact with negatively. Think about how your appearance, words, body language may affect your target. You want to appear open and inviting. Keep the conversation off yourself. We all love to talk about ourselves, and even more so if we feel we have a great story or account to share. It is human nature. Talking about yourself is one way to kill rapport. Let the other person talk about himself until he gets tired of it. You will be deemed an amazing friend, a perfect husband, a great listener, perfect sales guy, or whatever other title you are seeking. People feel good when they can talk about themselves. I guess we are all a little narcissistic, but by letting the other person do the talking, you will leave that interaction with his liking you a lot more. Keep the conversation off yourself. This point is especially cogent for social engineers. You have a definite goal in mind, and sometimes your judgment and direction can be clouded by what you want. Taking that focus off the target is dangerous as far as success goes. Let targets talk about their jobs, roles, and projects and be amazed at how much information they release. Remember that empathy is key to rapport. Empathy, defined by Random House Dictionary as the intellectual identification with or vicarious experiencing of the feelings, thoughts, or attributes of another, is lacking in many people today, and is especially hard to feel if you think you have the solution to someone's problem. However, really listening to what someone is saying, trying to identify and understand the underlying emotions, and then using reflection skills can make a person feel as if you are really in tune with them. I felt it necessary to provide the definition of empathy because understanding what it is you have to do is important. Notice that you must intellectually identify with and then experience the feelings, thoughts, or attitudes of someone else. These aren't always serious, depressing, or extreme emotions. Even understanding why someone is irritated, tired, or not in the best mood can go a long way. Imagine you go to the bank drive-thru and the teller lady gives you a monster attitude because you forgot to sign your check and she now has to send it back. You also forgot a pin and need to ask her for yet another favor. Your reaction might be similar to mine, especially if she gave you the eye roll and the irritated glance. You want to tell her that she is here to serve you. Instead, try saying this. It appears you might be a little irritated. I understand that. I get irritated when I have to deal with my forgetful clients, too. I hate to ask this, but could I please get a pen? It's important to not be patronizing when attempting to show empathy. If your empathy seems to come off haughty or arrogant, you can make the target feel like you are patronizing them. You acknowledge her being upset, but without accusation, showed that you have the same feelings, and then made a request. Empathy can go a long way toward building rapport. One caveat is that rapport cannot be faked. People need to feel you are genuinely concerned to build that trust relationship. If you are not a natural at displaying empathy, then practice. Practice with your family, friends, co-workers, teachers, or classmates. However and wherever you do it, practicing being empathetic will greatly improve your relationship building skills. Empathy is a tool of the social engineer. Unfortunately, it is also used often in malicious social engineering. When a catastrophe hits somewhere in the world, a malicious social engineer is often there to empathize with you. The thing that probably makes this tool so easy for malicious social engineers to use in many cases is because they truly are from bad, poor, or impoverished places. Makes appearing empathetic to others' plights in life easy, and therefore creates rapport automatically. Nothing builds rapport more than when people feel like you get them. This is proven very true when someone is a victim of disaster. It's a scary thought, but those who have been victims of abuse, crime, rape, natural disasters, war, or other atrocities on Earth often can understand the feelings of those who are experiencing them. This opens victims up to trusting the wrong type of people if that rapport is built. As mentioned before, when the 9/11 attacks happened in New York City, many people claimed to have lost family or friends in terrorist attacks. That made people empathize, and therefore these victims were given money, fame, or whatever they were seeking. As a social engineering auditor, you must be able to have a broad range of emotions that you can tap. Being closed in your emotions makes being empathetic very hard. This point goes along with really liking people. If you do, you won't have a hard time getting to know them and their stories and empathizing with them. Be well-rounded in your general knowledge. Knowledge is power. You don't have to know everything about everything, but having some knowledge about some things is a good idea. It makes you interesting and gives you something to base a conversation on. Knowledge is power. The old hacker mantra comes back to you as a social engineer. A social engineer should be a reader and a studier. If you fill your head with knowledge, then you will have something to talk about when you approach a target. Don't neglect reading, researching, and studying about the topic of the target's occupation or hobbies. Your goal is not to be a know-it-all and become an expert on every topic, but rather to have enough knowledge that you don't look at the target with a blank stare when she asks, "Did you bring an RJ45 connector with you to fix the server's network connection issues?" Develop your curious side. People normally feel a little self-righteous when it comes to their beliefs or thoughts on the way things should be done. That self-righteous or judgmental attitude can change the way a person reacts to something being said. Even if you don't say anything, you may start to think it. You can show in your body language or facial expressions. Instead of being self-righteous, develop a curiosity about how other people think and do things. Being curious keeps you from making a rash judgment. This can be applied by being humble enough to ask for help or ask for more information. Be open-minded enough to look into and accept another's thoughts on a topic, even if those thoughts differ from yours. Curiosity did not kill the social engineer. This point doesn't change much from a non-social engineer perspective. When you become curious about others' lifestyles, cultures, and languages, you begin to understand what makes people tick. Being curious also keeps you from being rigid and unbending in your personal judgments. You may not personally agree with certain topics, beliefs, or actions, but if you can remain curious and non-judgmental, then you can approach a person by trying to understand why he is, acts, or portrays a certain way instead of judging him. Find ways to meet people's needs. This point is the pinnacle of the list and is one of the most powerful points in the book. Dr. William Glasser wrote a book called Choice Theory, in which he identified 4 fundamental psychological needs for humans. 1. Belonging, connecting, love. 2. Power, significance, competence. 3. Freedom, responsibility. 4. Fun, learning. The principle behind this point is that creating ways for people to get these needs met by conversing with you builds instant rapport. If you can create an environment to provide those needs for people, you can create bonds that are unbreakable. Let me tell you a brief story about how powerful meeting people's needs can be. I was in a minor car accident. A young driver pulled out in front of me and then decided to stop. I had a split second to decide between hitting him, going 55 miles per hour, or veering off away from him and then launching my car over a small ditch into the side of a mountain. I chose in a second not to kill the 3 young people in the car. My car went airborne until I was stopped by a solid rock. I watched my beautiful little customized Jetta crumple under the weight, and my face smacked the windshield. I barely nicked the driver's rear bumper, but I was moving fast enough that his car was sideways on the highway. When I was able to get my bearings, we called the cops and an ambulance. The young man had a different insurance company than I did. The next morning, I got a call from his agent, who politely asked me questions. He told me that an adjuster would come out to see my now crumpled Jetta, and within 48 hours, I was handed a check and a letter stating that they would cover all medical costs for my recovery. I was then given a follow-up call from his insurance agent to see whether I was okay. How many calls from my insurance company do you think I got? I got 1 just to tell me how to answer questions. I understand that caring about each person is not the job of these large companies, but the other agent called me just to see whether I was okay. I fought no battles to get paid, and I was given a very fair price for my car. 2 days after that, I canceled my insurance and went to see Eric, the insurance agent who called me, from the young man's company. I told him I was so impressed that I wanted what he was selling. It has been 12 years now, and I use Eric for every insurance need I have. About 2 years ago, I got a call from an insurance company offering me rates that were substantially lower than what Eric and his company offer. I could even think about doing that to Eric. Why? Rapport. Plain and simple. Eric is my friend, my helper, someone I can call about questions on insurance, and someone who will always give me the best advice. He cares, he knows my family, and he never tries to hard sell me. He doesn't have to, because I will buy whatever he has because I trust him. This is the power of rapport. I don't know. Maybe Eric's end game in checking on me was to get me to move to his insurance practice, although I doubt it. Knowing him, he actually cares, and anyone who knows him says the same thing. His brother and he run a solid business. Rapport can create bonds between people that transcend cost or loss. Filling a need for the person you are talking to drastically increases the chances of building rapport. Do it without appearing to have an end game. Do it with a genuine desire to help and be amazed at the results. Perhaps no other avenue is more valuable for social engineers than being able to meet these needs. Learning how to create an environment that allows the target to feel comfortable and get one of the basic four fundamental needs met is a sure way to ensure unbreakable rapport. Spies use this principle of filling a need or desire often. In a recent trip to a South American country, I was told that its government is infiltrated all the time via fulfilling a basic need of connecting or love. A beautiful woman will be sent to seduce a man, but this is no one-night stand. She will seduce him for days, weeks, months, or even years. As time continues, she will get bolder, and her requests for where they are intimate eventually making their way to his office, where she gains access to plant bugs, trojans, or clone devices. This method is devastating, but it works. Social engineers fill desires through phishing emails also. In one test, 125 employees of a very reputable company were sent fake image files labeled BritneyNaked.jpg, MileySyrusShowering.jpg, and other such names, and each image was encoded with malicious code that would give the social engineer access to the user's computer. The results were that more than 75% of the images were clicked. What was found was the younger the star mentioned in the picture, the higher the click ratio. These disgusting and devastating facts show how well fulfilling people's desires can work. In person, too, it is no different. Police interrogators use this tactic for building rapport all the time. One time, I interviewed a law enforcement agent for a podcast I did at social-engineer.org. The guest told a story that proves this point about the power of rapport to make people comply with requests. The officers had arrested a man who was a peeping Tom. He had a fetish where he loved to invade the privacy of women who wore pink cowboy boots. The agent, instead of judging him for the freak he is, used phrases like, "I like red ones myself," and "I saw this girl the other day wearing short shorts and high cowboy boots. Wow." After just a short time, he began to relax. Why? He was among like-minded people. He felt connected, part of the crowd. Their comments put him at ease, and he began to spill his guts about his habits. The proceeding is a nice example of how to develop and build rapport, but how can you use it as a social engineer? You can build rapport in a matter of seconds by applying the principles of building rapport discussed earlier. To prove this, imagine you need to grab some cash. You don't have your ATM card on you, and you forgot your account number, so you have to go in and ask someone for help. Maybe you feel a little embarrassed about having to ask for your account number. You walk into a local branch of your bank you have never been into. No one is in the bank, and you have your choice of tellers. Maybe you don't think about it. Most people don't. But you will look over at the open lanes and choose the person who makes you feel the most comfortable. You will get the same results from each lane, but you will choose the one that makes you feel okay. Maybe you choose the most attractive person, or the one with the biggest smile, or the one who greets you first. Whomever you choose and however you choose them, You make the choice either consciously or unconsciously. But a lot of it has to do with rapport. The same principle will prove true when it comes to you and your target. As you walk up to a target, she will make instantaneous snap judgments of you based on your personal appearance, demeanor, facial expressions, and, of course, her mood. Most of these factors you can control, so take preemptive action on them to ensure success. Building rapport properly creates a bonding like strong glue that can withstand minor inconvenience and even some misunderstanding. Rapport allows a person to say and do things that only friends can do, because he or she is brought into that inner circle of trust. It is a powerful force without which salespeople, friendships, employment, and many other situations are much more difficult. Remember Chapter 4 on pretexting? You learned that pretexting is more than just playing a part. It is living, being, and becoming the person you are portraying to the target. Having a strong pretext is imperative to building the right kind of rapport. In many social engineering engagements, you will not have the time to build a storyline and use long-term seduction or rapport techniques, so your success will be based on many of the nonverbal things you will need to do. Using other rapport-building techniques. Other rapport-building techniques exist that are based in NLP research. As you know now, rapport is basically connecting with someone and putting him or her at ease. Some NLP techniques used by hypnotists and NLP practitioners can put people at ease instantly, as discussed next. Breathing at the same rate as your target. Breathing at the same rate as someone doesn't mean you closely listen to every breath and try to breathe in and out when your target does. But some people have very defined breathing patterns. Some have fast and short breathing. And some have long and deep breathing. Notice how the target breathes and mirror that pattern, but without parroting, that is, doing it at the exact same time. Matching your target's vocal tone and speech pattern. I was born in New York and raised in an Italian family. I talk fast and loud and with my hands. In addition to being 75% Italian, I'm 25% Hungarian. I am big, tall, and loud, and gesture like a professional sign language translator on speed. If I approach a timid, shy, slow-talking southerner, I can kill rapport if I do not slow down, put the hands away, and change my communication style. Listen to your target's vocal tone and match yours to his, whether he is a slow, fast, loud, quiet, or soft speaker. As for accents, a good rule is don't try unless you can do it very well. Don't attempt it. A poorly done accent is a rapport killer. Along these same lines, you can also try to listen for key phrases. People use terms like okie dokie or yepper. And even if they are out there, you might be able to work them into a sentence. Once I was talking with a target who would say things like, "It's six of one, half a dozen of another." I don't use that phrase a lot, and I didn't want to screw it up because that would create a lack of rapport. Instead, I would mix in some of the key words of that phrase and say things like, "I must have done that a half dozen times." How someone talks is also an area where you should restrict your personal judgment. Some people are close talkers. Some are whisperers. Some are touchers. If you are not, you need to allow a person freedom to talk the way he or she is comfortable, and then mirror it. Matching your target's body language. Matching body language is a very interesting avenue of rapport building, mainly because it can work to create very strong bonds, but at the same time, it can kill all your rapport in a matter of seconds in the case of a mismatch. If you notice someone standing a certain way, maybe with both arms crossed, don't assume she is shutting you out. Maybe she's just cold. You can cross one arm across your body to mirror her stance, or fold your hands into a steeple. When sitting across from someone who is eating a meal, you can take a few sips from your drink while he eats to mirror him. Do not do everything he does, but make similar actions. People like people who are like themselves. That is just human nature. It makes them feel comfortable. Bill Phillips was the genius behind the Body for Life program that changed the way workout programs were developed. He promoted something that was heavily tied to the mirroring principle. If you are fat and you only hang out with fat people, the chance of your changing is slim to none. Why? The answer is that you are comfortable with being fat and with people who are also comfortable with being fat. If you want to change that, then hang out with skinny people, and a mental change will quickly happen. This principle is the same in social engineering. You don't want your targets to make a change, so you need to be like them. You want them to feel good with you. Testing rapport. Using these alternative rapport-building techniques, as well as matching energy levels, facial expressions, and the like, can build rapport on a subliminal level. After trying some of these tactics, you can test your rapport by making a movement, like scratching your head or rubbing your ear, and if in the next minute or two you see your target make a similar movement, you probably have developed some strong rapport. These techniques can work wonders in many parts of your life when developing, building, and starting relationships with others. Learning how to use the psychological principles included in this chapter can make a huge difference in your social engineering practice. For years, there has been a myth that the human mind can be overwritten like a program. Is it just a myth? Can the human mind be mastered? The next section reveals some of the most mind-blowing information in this book. The Human Buffer Overflow. A glass can only hold so much liquid. If you have an 8-ounce glass and you try to pour 10 ounces of liquid into it, what will happen? It will overflow and spill all over the place. If you try to force the container to hold more liquid than it is meant to, you can eventually break the glass due to pressure. Computer programs work in a similar manner. Imagine you have a small program that has only one purpose and two fields, username and password. When the program opens, you see a little screen where you type in admin in the username field and password in the password field. A little box appears that says OK, signifying all is good. The developer allocated a certain amount of memory space for the username field, enough to hold the word admin a couple of times. What happens if you put 20 A's in that field and click OK? The program crashes and gives you an error message. Why? The input entered is longer than the allocated space, and without proper error handling, the program throws an exception and crashes. The goal of software hackers is to find the address that the program will call upon in a crash and insert malicious code into that address. By controlling the execution flow, the hacker can tell the program to execute any program he desires. He can inject commands of any type into the memory space of that program because he now controls it. As a penetration tester, few things are more exciting than seeing a program execute commands you tell it to. The human mind runs software, and over the years you build instruction sets, buffers, and memory links into your software package. Before applying this to the human mind, definitions of a few technical terms are necessary. A buffer is an area of space that is given for something to happen or to hold data. As in the simplistic glass of water example, the password field is given a buffer, which is the number of characters that it is allowed to have. If a larger number than the buffer is entered, the programmer needs to tell the program to do something with the larger than necessary data set. If he doesn't, the computer crashes and your program shuts down. Often what happens in the background is the program didn't know what to do with all the data, so it overflowed the allocated space, crashed the program, and exited. Hence the term buffer overflow. The human mind works in a similar way. Space is allocated for certain data sets. If a certain data set does not fit the space we have for it, what happens? Unlike a computer, your brain doesn't crash, but it does open up a momentary gap that allows for a command to be injected so the brain can be told what to do with the extra data. A human buffer overflow is basically the same principle. The goal is to identify a running program and insert codes into that program that will allow you to inject commands and, in essence, control the movement of thought to a certain direction. Setting the ground rules. In a paper entitled Modification of Audible and Visual Speech, researchers Michelle Covell, Malcolm Slaney, Christopher Bregler, and Margaret Withcott state that scientists have proven that people speak 150 words per minute but think at 500 to 600 words per minute. This means that most people you talk to can jump around your conversations in their head. So overflowing the brain through fast speech seems almost impossible. You must also understand how people make decisions in life. People make most of their decisions subconsciously, including how to drive to work, get coffee, brush their teeth, and what clothes to wear without really thinking about it. Have you ever driven all the way to work, and when you get there, you can't remember what billboards you passed, what route you took, or that traffic accident on the news? You were in a state of mind where your subconscious took over and did what you always do without you consciously thinking about every turn. Most decisions people make are like this. Some scientists even believe people make decisions up to 7 seconds earlier in their subconscious before making them in the real world. When people finally do make a decision consciously, they do it from more than just what they hear. Sights, feelings, and emotions become involved in the decision. Understanding how humans work and think can be the quickest way to creating a buffer overflow, or an overflow of the natural programs of the human mind, so you can inject commands. Fuzzing the human OS. In actual software hacking, a method called fuzzing is used to find errors that can be overwritten and give control to a malicious hacker. Fuzzing is where the hacker throws random data at the program in differing lengths to see what makes it crash, because it cannot handle the data. That gives the hacker a path to inject malicious code. Just like fuzzing a program, you must understand how the human mind reacts to certain types of data. Presenting people with different sets of decisions or different sets of data, then seeing how they react, can tell us the programs they are running. Certain laws in the human mind seem to be inherent that everyone follows. For example, if you approach a building with two sets of doors, one outer, one inner, and you hold the first set open for a complete stranger, what do you think he will do next? He will either hold the next set open for you, or make sure that set stays open until you get inside. If you are in a line of merging traffic and you let a complete stranger merge in front of you, most likely if you need to merge later on, he would let you in without even thinking. Why? The reason has to do with the law of expectations, which states that people usually comply with an expectation. Decisions are usually made based on what the person feels the requester expects him or her to do. One way you can start sending your malicious data to the brain program is called presupposition. By giving the target something first, the request you make next will be expected to be followed. A simple example for you to test is with the doors. Hold a door for someone, and most likely that person will at least make an attempt to ensure the next set of doors is open for you. A social engineer can do this by first giving the target a compliment or a piece of information they deem valuable before the request is made. Giving that over first creates in them the need to comply with a future request as it is expected. Presupposition can be described best via an example. Did you know my next-door neighbor Ralph always drives a green Ford Escort? In this sentence, you presuppose, I know my neighbor. His name is Ralph. He has a driver's license. He drives a green car. To use presupposition effectively, you ask a question using words, body language, and facial expressions that indicate what you are asking is already accepted. The basic gist of this method is to bypass the firewall, the conscious mind, and gain access directly to the root of the system, the subconscious. The quickest way to inject your own code is through embedded commands, discussed next. The rules of embedded commands. Some basic principles of embedded commands make them work. Usually the commands are short, 3 to 4 words. Slight emphasis is needed to make them effective. Hiding them in normal sentences is the most effective use. Your facial and body language must support the commands. Embedding commands are popular in marketing with things like buy now, act now, follow me. In a real buffer overflow, exploit writers use padding, which is a method of adding some characters that do not interrupt the execution but allow a nice little landing pad that leads to the malicious code. Social engineers can utilize phrases that are like padding to help the next command have a soft place to land when it is injected, such as, when you? How do you feel when you? A person can, as you. All of these statements create an emotion or a thought that allows you to inject code into the subconscious. Many examples of embedded commands exist, but here are a few to ponder. Using quotes or stories. The brain tends to process stories differently than other information. Some of the greatest teachers who have ever lived, Aristotle, Plato, Gamaliel, Jesus, all used stories and illustrations to teach those listening to them. Why? The unconscious mind processes stories as direct instructions. Bandler, one of the fathers of NLP, taught that NLP practitioners need to learn to use quotes. He knew the power of stories or quotes would give the speaker power over the thinking of his listeners. Reading quotes, using quotes, and then embedding commands into quotes can be a powerful use of this technique. For example, in one situation, I needed to manipulate a target to give me an old password so I could change it to a more secure password, and they automatically questioned why there was a need to change old passwords. I used something like this. A recent study by Xavier Research, Inc. stated that 74% of people use weak passwords in corporate America. That is the reason we launched a program to change passwords corporate-wide. I will perform that password change for you. I need for you to give me your old Windows password, and then I will make that change now. By quoting a research facility, it added weight to my words about why this change had to occur. Using negation. Negation is much like reverse psychology. By telling the target to not do something too much, you can embed a command into the sentence. For example, if I tell you, don't spend too much time practicing the use of embedded commands, I can slip the command, practice the use of embedded commands, into my sentence. I also can presuppose that you will practice it to some extent. And if you are stubborn, you might say, you can't tell me what to do. I will practice all I want. Telling a person that something is not important or relevant makes his unconscious pay extra attention so he can determine whether it is relevant or not. You can embed commands in negative sentences like the earlier example that will leave the listener no option but to take action. Forcing the listener to use his imagination. This method works when you ask the listener a question using phrases such as, what happens? Or, how do you feel when? For which he must imagine something to answer it. If you ask, what happens when you become rich and famous? The listener has to internally imagine the time he might be rich and famous to answer the question. If you ask, what happens when you master the use of embedded commands? I am forcing you to imagine becoming a master and how you will feel when that happens. Think of it this way. If I tell you, do not imagine a red cow, you have to picture a red cow first to tell yourself not to think about it. Your unconscious mind is responsible for interpreting each word in a set of commands into something it can represent and then give meaning to. By the time your brain has understood the sentence, your unconscious has imagined it. The unconscious mind processes statements directly with no regard to context. The other great part is that the unconscious can track body language, facial expressions, vocal tones, and gestures, and then connect each of them to the message being spoken. While it is connecting the dots, so to speak, the unconscious mind has little option but to comply if an embedded command exists. What's important when using embedded commands is to not mess up your tones. If you overemphasize the words, then you will sound odd and scare the person off instead of embed commands. As with a software buffer overflow, the information must match the command you are trying to overflow. Summary. As you probably have already imagined, embedding commands is a vast field with a lot of room for error. You must practice to be very successful at it. Although I do not promote using this information for seduction, some decent videos exist about seduction that show how embedded commands can work. Using these principles can create an environment where the target is very receptive to your suggestions. Just because you tell the person, "You will purchase from me," does not mean he always will. So why use these commands? It creates a platform to make social engineering easier. Using these types of commands is also a good lesson for companies you work with to educate them about what to look for and how to spot someone who may be trying to use this type of social engineering tactic against them. If you were to write out this principle of embedded commands as an equation, you could write it this way. Human buffer overflow equals law of expectations plus mental padding plus embedded codes. Start a conversation with a target using phrases, body language, and assumptive speech. Presume the things you ask for are already as good as accomplished. Next, pad the human mind with some statements that make embedding commands easier, while at the same time embedding the command. In essence, this is the equation for the human buffer overflow. Use this equation sparingly, but practice a lot before you attempt it. Try it at work or home. Pick a target at work that might not normally comply with simple requests and try to see whether you can get him to serve you coffee. "Tom, I see you are heading into the kitchen. Will you get me a cup of coffee with 2 creams, please?" Escalate your commands to larger tasks to see how far you can get. Try to use this equation to get commitment from people. Eventually, use this equation to see how much information you can get and how many commands you can inject. This chapter covered some of the deepest and most amazing psychology principles in social engineering. This chapter alone can change your life, as well as your ability as a social engineer. Understanding how people think, why they think a certain way, and how to change their thoughts is a powerful aspect of being a social engineer. Next on the docket, how to influence your target. Chapter 6. Influence. The power of persuasion. If you would persuade, you must appeal to interest rather than intellect. Benjamin Franklin. The epigraph sums up this entire chapter. You might be wondering why I didn't include this within Chapter 5's discussion of psychological principles of social engineering. Psychology is a science, and a set of rules exists in it that, if followed, will yield a result. Social engineering psychology is scientific and calculated. Influence and persuasion are much like art that is backed up by science. Persuasion and influence involve emotions and beliefs. As discussed in some of the earlier chapters, you have to know how and what people are thinking. Influence and the art of persuasion is the process of getting someone else to want to do, react, think, or believe in the way you want them to. That is probably one of the most powerful sentences in the book. It means using the principles discussed herein, you will be able to move someone to think, act, and maybe even believe the way you want him to because he wants to. Social engineers use the art of persuasion every day, and unfortunately, malicious scammers and social engineers use it too. Some people have devoted their life to researching, studying, and perfecting the art of influence. Those such as Dr. Ellen Langer, Robert Cialdini, and Kevin Hogan have contributed a very large repository of knowledge in this field. Mix this knowledge with the research and teachings of NLP masters such as Bandler, Grinder, and more recently, Jamie Smart, and what you have is a recipe to become a true artist. True influence is elegant and smooth and most of the time undetectable to those being influenced. When you learn the methods, you will start to notice them in commercials, on billboards, and when used by salespeople. You will start to get irritated at the shoddy attempts of marketing people. And if you're like me, you will begin to rant and rave at terrible commercials and billboards while driving, which does not make my wife very happy. Before getting into how social engineers will use influence and persuasion, the chapter begins with a short tour of some of the key elements of persuasion and influence that I have compiled and used. This chapter will discuss things like reciprocation, manipulation, and the power of setting goals, just to name a few of these key elements. Influence and persuasion can be broken down into five important aspects, as discussed in the following sections. The five fundamentals of influence and persuasion. The five fundamentals of persuasion are crucial in obtaining any type of successful influence upon a target. Setting clear goals. Building rapport, being observant of your surroundings, being flexible, getting in touch with yourself. The whole goal of social engineering is to influence the target to take an action that may or may not be in their best interest. Yet they will not only take the action, but want to take the action, and maybe even thank you for it at the end. This type of influence is powerful and can make a social engineer who possesses these skills legendary. World-renowned NLP trainer Jamie Smart once said, "The map is not the territory." I love that quote because it blends perfectly with these five fundamentals. None of them are the whole sum on their own, but individually, they are like points on a map that show you the whole territory of what you want to accomplish. The following section delves deep into the first fundamental, why setting clear goals is very important. Have a clear goal in mind. Not only should you have a clear goal in mind, you should even go so far as to write it down. Ask yourself, what do I want of this engagement or interaction? As I discussed in Chapter 5, especially in relation to NLP, a human's internal systems are affected by his thoughts and goals. If you focus on something, you may be more likely to become it or get it. This doesn't mean that if you focus on the thought of getting $1 million, you will get it. In fact, it is unlikely. However, if you had a goal of making $1 million and focused on the steps needed to make that money, your goals, education, and actions would increase the likelihood of you achieving that goal. The same is true with persuasion. What is your goal? Is it to change someone's beliefs? To get him to take an action. Suppose a dear friend is doing something terribly unhealthy and you want to try and persuade her to stop. What is the goal? Maybe the end goal is to persuade her to stop, but maybe little goals exist along the way. Outlining all of these goals can make the path to influencing that person clearer. After setting the goal, you must ask yourself, how will I know when I have gotten it? I once listened to a training program offered by Jamie Smart, one of the world's leaders on NLP, and he asked each person in the classroom these two questions. What do you want? How will you know when you have it? At this point, I paused the CD for the first question and answered for myself out loud what I wanted from this course. Then I pressed play again, and when he asked that second question, how will you know you have gotten it, I paused the CD again and was lost. I knew what I wanted out of that course, but I didn't know how to gauge when I had gotten it. Knowing what you want out of your engagements is an important aspect of influence and persuasion. When you approach a target, knowing what your goals are and what the indicators are that you are getting what you want, then you can clearly identify the path you need to take. Clearly defined goals can make or break the success of the influence tactics used by a social engineer, as well as make the next step much easier to master. Rapport, rapport, rapport. Chapter 5 has a whole section on rapport building. Study it and perfect your rapport building skills. Developing rapport means that you get the attention of the person you are targeting and his unconscious mind, and you build trust within that unconscious portion. Mastering the skill of building rapport can change the way you deal with people, and when it comes to social engineering, it can change your whole methodology. To build rapport, start where the person you want to influence is mentally. Try to understand their frame of mind. Are they suspicious? Are they upset, sad, or worried? Whatever emotional state you perceive them to be in, start from there. Do not focus on your goals as much as focusing on understanding the person. This is a very vital point. This means a social engineer must understand his target enough that they can imagine where they are consciously. What are the target's thoughts and state of mind? For example, imagine you want to influence your dear friend to want to quit smoking or doing drugs or something else. Notice you don't want to convince her to quit, but convince her to want to quit. Your goal cannot be about you, right? It must focus on the target. You can't start your conversation with what her addiction is doing to you and how much you hate the smell and so on. The argument has to be what is in it for her. You cannot start the conversation with a verbal attack about what the person has done to you with her habit, but you need to understand where that person's frame of mind is, accept it, and come to an alignment with it. Social engineering is much the same. You can't start where you are mentally. This is going to be a struggle for many people. Do you know why she smokes? Do you understand the psychological, physical, or mental reasons why? Until you can really get into her shoes, you cannot build a strong rapport, and your efforts and influence will fail. In addition, you cannot always base the idea of building rapport on logic. I was once in the hospital with a dear friend who was dying from throat cancer. He had smoked for more than 40 years, and one day he found out he had cancer. It spread fast, bringing him to the hospital to live out his last days. His children would come to visit, and every now and then they would leave the room. I thought they were overcome with emotion. One time, after they excused themselves, I went out to comfort them, and they were outside the hospital, smoking. I was dumbfounded. I don't smoke and have no desire to. And although I can understand how strong an addiction can be, I couldn't understand how, after seeing the pain their father was in, how they could raise a cigarette to their lips. Logic would not win in this case. Telling my friend's children why smoking is bad and how it will kill them would do no good. This information was useless because it was combative and only made me feel good in saying it, but did not align with their present frame of mind. Until you understand the person, you cannot successfully build a good enough rapport to influence him or her. Getting someone to want to do something is a blend of emotion and logic, as well as understanding and humility in many cases. Once, I walked into an office I was going to do some work for, and I had heard a funny comment outside. So when I walked in the main lobby, I was chuckling. The woman behind the desk must have just done something embarrassing because when she saw me, she immediately got angry and yelled at me. It's not funny, and you're a jerk. Now, I didn't know this woman, and to tell you the truth, I had a goal in mind that this interaction was not going to help. In addition, I felt insulted that she assumed I was laughing at her and wanted to lash back at her. But instead, I saw she was upset. I got close to the counter so as not to embarrass her anymore. I looked her in the eye and with sincerity said, "I'm sorry if you thought I was laughing at you. I was in the parking lot and some of your workmates were telling a story about a party over the weekend and I thought it was very funny." She looked at me and I could tell she was now even more embarrassed. So, to save face for her, I loudly said, "Ma'am, I'm sorry for laughing and embarrassing you." This allowed her to save face to those around us. She understood that I took one for the team, and she responded with extreme kindness. A minute later, she apologized, and it worked to my benefit as I was given all the data I asked for, data I normally would have had to work very hard to get. A teacher I had once used to tell me, "Kill them with kindness." That is a pretty powerful statement. Being kind to people is a quick way to build rapport and to establish yourself in the five fundamentals of persuasion and influence. One method to influence people using kindness and rapport is to ask questions and give choices that lead them to the path you want. For example, once I was influenced to take a job I really didn't want as part of a team effort. The team leader was very charismatic and friendly, and had the charm factor that allowed him to speak to anyone. He approached me and said, "Chris, I wanted to talk to you separately from the team. I need a right hand for a small project, but the person needs to be a go-getter, self-motivated. I think this is you, but I don't want to assume. What do you think?" I was excited and flattered by the compliments and the potential to be important, so I responded, "I am a very self-motivated person. Whatever you need, tell me." The team leader continued, "Well, I am a big believer in leading by example, and I think you have that leadership quality. The problem is, some on the team do not, and they need a strong person to show them how it is done." Before the end of the conversation, what he wanted appeared as if it was my idea, which made it impossible to back out of. Powerful indeed. And all started with the power of persuasion. Be in tune with yourself and your surroundings. Being aware of yourself and your surroundings, or sensory acuity, is the ability to notice the signs in the person you are targeting and yourself that will tell you that you are moving in the right direction or not. Many of the principles discussed in the previous chapter apply to persuasion. Reading body language and facial signs can tell you much about your influence on the person. To really master the dual art of influence and persuasion, you have to become a master watcher and a master listener. Chris Westbury, a cognitive neuropsychologist at the University of Alberta in Canada, estimates that human brains process information at 20 million billion calculations per second. Those calculations are represented by facial expressions, micro expressions, gestures, posture, voice tones, eye blinks, breathing rate, speech patterns, nonverbal utterances, and many more types of distinguishing patterns. Mastering influence means to be aware of those subtle things in yourself and others. I found for myself the ability to be observant proved to be easier for me after receiving some training from Dr. Ekman in microexpressions. I found afterward that not only did I become much more aware of what was going on with those around me, but also myself. When I felt a certain expression on my face, I was able to analyze it and see how it might be portrayed to others. This recognition of myself and my surroundings was one of the most enlightening experiences of my life. NLP experts promote minimizing your internal dialogue when trying to influence others. If you approach the target thinking about the next stage of the attack, the end goal, or comebacks for potential conversation stoppers, the internal dialogue can cause you to miss a lot of what is going on around you. Being observant takes a lot of work, but the payoff is well worth it. Don't act insane. Be flexible. What do I mean by not acting insane and being flexible? One definition of insanity that's been floating around for years is doing the same thing over and over and